2007 will come to order. And our first item is a public hearing on Senate Bill 39, which we will open now. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 39 comes from the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. Does a number of things related to tax compliance. It requires taxpayers to notify the Department of Revenue when engaging in a reportable transaction and creates new penalties for users of reportable and listed transactions and for promoters of tax shelters. It also opens closed tax years under certain conditions going back to 1999. In front of you, you have an SMS and a revenue impact statement. You also have a document entitled Section-by-Section Description. And yes. I'm just going to briefly touch on where the main points are in the bill to kind of walk through that very briefly. Section 2 just defines some terms for the bill, listed transaction and reportable transaction. And these are terms that are defined in federal law, and they're also defined for purposes of this bill. And one, I guess, easy way to think about these transactions is that listed transactions are transactions that have been declared illegal by the IRS, and they are specifically identified in the Internal Revenue Code, a list of transactions, and that's where the name comes from. Reportable transactions are a superset, if you will, of listed transactions. Reportable transactions include listed transactions, as well as transactions that could be illegal depending on how they were used. So it's a little unclear on the reportable transaction piece. And
I'm sorry, would you hit that one again a little more slowly?
And the terms, two of the key terms with respect to this bill are listed transactions and reportable transactions. Listed transactions are transactions defined by the IRC. There's literally a list of the transactions, and that's where the name comes from, and they are deemed illegal transactions at the federal level. Reportable transactions is often used in conjunction with listed transactions. Reportable transactions, in terms of defining that term, they include listed transactions, but they include other transactions that are not necessarily illegal. It depends on how the transaction is used.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Well, Mr. Chair, that wasn't too confusing.
Thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you.
Section 3 of the bill requires the taxpayers who engage in or associated with or receive a tax benefit from a reportable transaction to report that transaction to the Department of Revenue beginning the tax year 2007. And that requirement exists because the transaction could be perfectly legitimate. It's just telling the taxpayer that they have to tell the Department of Revenue that they engaged in that transaction. Section 8 of the bill, sections 4 through 7 were deleted by amendment. Section 8 creates a 60% penalty for an understatement of tax liability due to the use of a listed transaction and applies to transactions discovered or reported on or after January 1, 2008. So that is a new tax penalty in state code, and it defines listed transaction understatement. That's the amount of tax that was underpaid due to the use of a listed transaction. Section 9 creates a new penalty for failing to report to the Department of Revenue the use of a reportable transaction. So in this case, if a taxpayer conducts one of these reportable transactions, which could be legitimate, but they fail to tell the department about it, it's a $3,300 fine for individuals and a $16,700 penalty for corporations. If that reportable transaction happens to be a listed transaction, then the fine is substantially more, $33,000 for individuals and $66,000 for corporations. Sections 12 through 13 create another penalty, this not for the taxpayers, but for people who promote tax shelters. And tax shelters are defined in the IRC. And the penalty is 100% of the amount of the gross income derived in promoting the tax shelter. So that's an additional penalty for a different taxpayer. Sections 18 to 21 open the tax years going back to 1999 if certain conditions are met. Basically, if the listed transaction was used and that usage led to a tax deficiency, then the Department of Revenue has the ability to open those tax years, issue a notice of deficiency, and collect on that tax. But that would only pertain to any tax underpayment related to that listed transaction. The Department of Revenue couldn't use this as a way to open a tax rep, open up a closed tax year, and then search for other things. They would only be able to collect on the tax related to a listed transaction. And that's the sum total of the bill. The bill started off as a number of other pieces. There was a voluntary compliance initiative and a tax amnesty and so forth, and that's why all of these various sections were deleted. It just boils down to new penalties being created and closed years being open for the Department of Revenue for a certain time period. The revenue impact statement that you have shows a projected increase in tax revenue, tax collections for 07-09. And one of the key pieces of this is that the Department of Revenue, and I think you're going to hear about this today, is intending to participate in a multi-state compliance initiative later this year. And this bill was seen as a way to encourage response to that voluntary compliance initiative, because if taxpayers come forward with to report listed transactions that they have partaken in and essentially file amended returns, they can do so in 07 without the new, that 60% penalty taking effect. That 60% penalty doesn't take effect until January 1, 2008. So if the taxpayers come forward during this effort later this year, then that 60% penalty doesn't exist. They don't have to pay that. But if they don't come forward then, and it's discovered or reported after January 1, 2008, then the 60% penalty applies. And that's essentially where that bulk of the revenue comes in 07-09, and there is in 09-11 there's an impact of $1 million, and that's due to just new penalties that were contained in the bill.
Thank you. Questions about the summary? I see a member of the other chamber would like to be heard.
We try to be courteous.
As do we, Mr. Chair. Senator Rod Monroe, District 24, give you a little bit of history on how I got involved in this. When I was here before, which was a long time ago, I was chair of the Revenue Committee in the Senate for 4 years, and before that, vice chair in the House. So I've dealt with some revenue issues. The chair of the Senate Revenue Committee, Senator Deckert, pulled me aside about 2 weeks into the session and said, I got a little job for you. And he told me about the history of Senate Bill 480 from last session, how it was worked back and forth in both chambers and ended up dying, either from its own weight or from the lobbying activities of certain financial lobbyists. And so my instructions were to work with Representative Butler and perhaps Representative McPherson if he wanted to get involved, and to put together something based on Senate Bill 480 that would pass both chambers, hopefully without a lot of fuss. And so that's what we've done. We've scaled back considerably from where Senate Bill 480 was to deal with only the most egregious tax frauds and tax shelters, to identify them carefully, and then rather than do an amnesty, to simply impose those new penalties, but leave a time until January when taxpayers who were involved in these kinds of illegal, immoral transactions to come clean, pay their taxes before the new penalties take effect. Representative Butler and I headed up a work group that met for about several times over a period of nearly 3 months. It included Mr. Martinez, who's here today to testify with the bankers. It included Deborah with the department, who was very, very helpful, and included Chris. And Chris would, he would try to press for a little tougher bill, and Deborah would say, well, no, we think we can get along with the basic bill. So this is about as simple as we could make this bill. There are those people who wanted us to be more stringent, more to go after some of the gray areas, but Representative Butler and I decided early on we're going for the black and the white and kind of staying out of those areas that are that might lead to litigation. This is a clean bill, passed the Senate unanimously. There's not very many tax bills that pass the Senate unanimously. I would urge you to move it on and send it out of the House with a 60-0 vote. Happy to answer questions, Mr. Chair.
Questions for the good senator, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Senator Monroe, so how, when you're doing this just sort of delayed onset in lieu of an amnesty, how is it that people are going to know that this is happening?
The department is going to be notifying people. They have lists, federal lists. We've passed other bills that give them access to tax data from other states. Many of these are corporations that operate in many states, and the department has that information. But perhaps you're going to want to ask Deborah to come up, and she can give you more information. They're also involved with a statewide compact that you heard about that will be sharing information so that we know who these people are and we can go after them, let them know that unless they want to pay the heavier fines, they need to get clean right now.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
That seems like it's just an amnesty by without calling it an amnesty.
You can look at it that way if you'd like.
So why is it why is it preferable, I guess?
An amnesty would say your crimes are forgiven for a period of time. We haven't said that. We're not forgiving anybody anything. We're going to be imposing on them the penalties that are in current law. Even when they come clean during the next 8 months, we'll be imposing the penalties that are in current law. What they are avoiding is the greatly increased penalties that take effect in January.
I'm not sure why is that preferable to doing what some other states have done so successfully.
Tax amnesty is always controversial, Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenbaum. Tax amnesties are always controversial because some people think you're letting the bad guys off when you have a tax amnesty. So we're not doing that.
Thank you. And I think that we may have some additional questions for Deborah Buchanan when it's her turn on exactly these issues and current penalties and things of that sort. Other questions for Senator Monroe? Thank you, Senator. We really appreciate your testimony and all the work that you put in on this bill.
Thank you. And Representative Butler, I couldn't have done it without him. He is the expert on this topic.
Thank you. Thank you.
John.
Thank you.
For the department.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. As staff has explained, this particular bill is quite a bit different than Senate Bill 480 that was passed in one chamber last session. And if I could just elaborate on what the department is planning to do, whether this bill is adopted or not. We are currently undertaking what we're calling an administrative voluntary compliance initiative, not so much an amnesty for general taxpayers and the general population, but one that is more focused on people who have engaged in abusive tax shelters. That is starting just shortly. In fact, we're working with 18 other states and the Multi-State Tax Commission. We have a press release that we're working on now and letters that we have prepared to go out in order to inform people that have engaged in these shelters that they have an opportunity to file and pay the correct amount of tax and interest, and penalties would not be imposed. These penalties in Senate Bill 39 would take effect January 1 of 2008, and for those that don't come forward between now and January 1, 2008, if Senate Bill 39 is enacted, then they become subject to additional and increased penalties beginning 1-1 of 08. So again, we are planning to do that administrative VCI. What we see Senate Bill 39 doing is providing additional leverage to the department during this administrative VCI to encourage taxpayers to come forward and pay the correct amount of tax plus interest before the additional penalties take place. You heard discussion of what is a listed transaction, what is a reportable transaction. I've handed out three pieces of paper that list the listed transactions that are now in federal provisions. So again, these are only the federal provisions. You'll notice that Senate Bill 39A adopts the federal definition of listed transactions, so all of these would be adopted for Oregon purposes. We connect then to the federal definitions. In addition to that, there are two state-specific transactions, and those are shown on page 1 of Senate Bill 39A, starting with line 10. And these are transactions involving real estate investment trusts or regulated investment companies. So very narrow and very specific to the state. Other than that, those are the listed transactions, and you might just think of those as the bad transactions, those that are definitely set as being inappropriate to engage in under federal law and then under this state law. Most of these on this handout that I have given you, I don't even understand. But there is one on the last page that I think I could try to explain just as an example of what the IRS is looking at in defining listed transactions. On the last page, I'm sorry, I forgot to put page numbers on these, but there's an abusive Roth IRA transaction. Some of you might be familiar with what Roth IRAs are. Some of you might even have them. You can make contributions into a Roth IRA. When you make the contribution, you don't receive a deduction on the tax return, but eventually when you start pulling money out of that Roth IRA, it's tax-free to you. So the money that went in has already been taxed, the earnings accrue, but when the money comes out, it's tax-free. So what is the abusive transaction? What certain businesses were doing was contributing accounts receivable to a Roth IRA, but they were undervaluing the accounts receivable, taking a large discount on the value, contributing that to the Roth IRA. Then when they receive the payment on the account receivable at presumably the market value, they have money in the Roth IRA and it comes out tax-free. So you're converting ordinary income that you would report when you collect your accounts receivable into tax-free income. That's abusive. That's the type of transaction that the IRS is saying you shouldn't be engaging in. So that's the type of transaction that we would connect to as well. Reportable transactions, as staff explained, aren't necessarily bad. They aren't necessarily bad, but the IRS wants to know about them so that they can look at them. We want to know about them so that we can look at them. So what it is raising a red flag to say, we had one of these transactions, we're telling you about it, if you want to look at it, that's fine. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad. But if the taxing agencies can't figure out from looking at the return what's going on, this is helpful to them to allow them to examine those types of transactions. So again, that is a reportable transaction. Now, we could ask for that information now, and we do. We ask companies to report if they have engaged in listed transactions, but if they don't indicate that on the return, there's no consequence. We can't impose a penalty for not checking the box or attaching the form. So this says, if you don't tell us that you engaged in a transaction and we find out about that, there's a penalty for not saying it. In addition to that, if it was abusive, then there's an additional penalty if there's an understatement of tax associated with that.
And just to make certain I understand, you're talking about reportable transactions.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Reportable transactions. So again, we see this as something that's assisting with the administrative VCI that we're doing. There are other things that we think will encourage companies to come forward during the administrative VCI. One is that there's been a new accounting interpretation that's taken effect that requires publicly traded companies to disclose tax positions in their financial statements. Some companies may take advantage of this time period to come forward and report or even file with the state if they haven't done that already. Mr. Chairman, unless you want to go through the bill, and I think staff has pretty well done that already, section by section, I think that is the extent of what I wanted to say about Senate Bill 39A.
Thank you, Representative
Thank
Butler.
You.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deborah, one item that I continually receive from constituents and non-constituents who write to me about tax concerns and tax compliance concerns is the Walmart scheme. I think that's covered in Section 2. Perhaps you could just help us with the Walmart scheme, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, may I?
Oh, some more handouts. The Walmart scheme. I'm interested in learning about
it. It isn't just the happy smiley face with price cutting, after all.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, we have also received questions about that. The article that I'm passing out was in the Wall Street Journal a few months ago, and it describes a tax approach where a corporation... Well, let me back up and not speak specifically to Walmart, but just an example of what was happening. A corporation owns a building in Oregon. It's doing business in Oregon. It owns this building. And assume that the corporation establishes a real estate investment trust in Delaware, and it transfers ownership of the building to the real estate investment trust. The corporation then no longer owns the building where it has its business operations, so it's going to pay the entity that owns the building. So the Oregon Corporation is paying the real estate investment trust that's based in Delaware for the rent of the building that it's using in Oregon. The real estate investment trust then pays dividends back to the parent corporation because it has income, and as a real estate investment trust, it has to pay out at least 90% of its income in order not to be taxed. So it's paying dividends back to the corporation. The corporation then is taking a dividends received deduction for the dividends that it receives. The effect of this is that the corporation is essentially paying rent to itself but creating non-taxable income. This is less of a problem in Oregon because corporations file consolidated tax returns with Oregon. And in 2005, the legislature passed Senate Bill 31 that said if these are not dividends under federal law, they're not dividends under Oregon law either. So it eliminated the dividend received deduction, we think. Other states have taken the same approach, and what we are hearing from other states is that they haven't necessarily solved the problem because they're finding that corporations are dropping a subsidiary in between the corporation and the REIT, and then with the law that they have on their books, they're getting around that limitation. So it's not entirely clear that we've solved the problem with the REITs, but there was that attempt to do that.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Deborah, an attempt to solve it after we had realized that the REITs were still out there and that we tried to address it in the Recon Act in 31 in last session. I think that Section 2 of the bill does talk about the economic substance, and the economic substance of what we're talking about in uprating real estate merely to avoid the tax is, as my understanding from the work group with Senator Monroe, was basically a transaction which really was devoid of any business functionality other than to attempt to receive an income tax benefit. It lacked economic substance.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the language on page 1 of Senate Bill 39A does provide that a business would have to show that there's some economic substance to its transaction before it would be considered a valid transaction. So if the only purpose of doing whatever it is they're engaging in with the real estate investment trust is to avoid state tax, that's the only reason, then that would be considered a listed transaction under this bill.
And that's in addition to the ones that are listed pursuant to the Internal Revenue Code?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Butler. That's a very illustrative article and points out the point of these things, which I think is changing dollars from one form income into something else which incurs a lower or no tax without any real substance to the transaction.
And when we go off the record, Mr. Chair, I'll share with you that same issue. I baptized thee something else that thou aren't.
All right. Thank you. Further questions? Did you have other things you wanted to talk about?
I don't believe
we covered
I did.
Them? Yes, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this question was fully dealt with in Senate Bill 4E, but having not been here, I need to ask. I'm not sure if it's, it should be directed to Representative Butler or Deborah or someone else. Could someone kind of illustrate or explain the way you decided on the penalties? In one case, it's a percentage. In the other case, it looked like a flat number. I'm just curious about how those compare with the gains that might be ill-gotten.
In part, if I may, Mr. Chair, and Deborah will do an excellent job. In part, those look strange, like they were almost negotiated out. You'll see that basically, by and large, those were approximately one-third of the federal amount of penalty. In other words, the federal amount of penalty might be $100,000. You'll see that the state is $33,000. If it's $200,000 at the federal level, you'll see that it's $66,000 at state level. So we tried to pattern it after the federal level, anticipating that the federal tax might be two-thirds more than the state tax.
Thanks.
Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks. Deborah, I see that the analysis says minimal fiscal impact on this, but after you have gone through this process of publicizing that, you know, these new penalties will accrue and then imposing them, are you going to be, you're not going to need additional enforcement people to make sure that you've gotten out there and found the bad actors? I know Representative Buckley hates that expression, the miscreants or something.
I like that word better.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, we do think that we can do this with the existing staff. We're hoping that we will have a good response to the voluntary compliance initiative that we undertake and that there won't be that many that we find after January 1 of 08 that we would need to impose those additional penalties on them.
Because that you expect they're all going to just come forward, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, not all of them, but we do think that there will be a significant number and that will want to avoid the penalties that will take place. We have received information from California already on taxpayers that they have had come forward under their voluntary compliance initiative. We also receive information from the IRS through the revenue agent reports, and we've acted on those. So there has been additional revenue from those sources. But I could very well be wrong, and we may be back in February or the 09 session to report on our experience and say we think we need additional resources to help with this. But at the moment, we think we can do it with the staff that we have.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I might add to that that it's my understanding that the mining tools which you have available to you as a result of the data sharing and the resources that have been made available for additional technology are being employed and utilized right now in the current session and do not get taken away or reduced as part of your next budget year. So it's my hope that the department will continue. Two or three sessions ago, we weren't doing as good a job mining the data as we're presently doing, and the data source is much better as a result of the fact that we're laid on, if you will, to adopt the voluntary compliance initiative, but we have backdated it far enough that we shouldn't really lose anything in that process by backdating it to 99.
Thank you. Others? I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Very
Chair.
Much. We have two others who have asked to be heard, Bill Mann and Tim Martinez.
Good afternoon, committee. Mr. Chairman, for the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I don't think I testified this year they had Kleenex, so I hope you don't make me use it before the end of my presentation. Joining me is Bill Manny, a partner at Miller & Ash. He is a colleague of Brian Doherty. He'll be here to answer any specific questions on the tax piece itself. I would just like to, first of all, thank Senator Deckert for putting together the work group that was, as Senator Monroe said, chaired by himself and your vice chair, Representative Butler. This has been a long and contentious issue for the last couple of sessions. We believe that the product you have before you in 39A, while not perfect from anybody's perspective, is something that we're comfortable with and can support moving forward in the House. Would also like to thank, for those of you that were around last session, you know that Senator Deckert, this was one of his priorities, and he was extremely frustrated at the end of the session that the bill was not sent on to the governor for his signature. But I think the fact that he moved this bill and was comfortable with it and voted for it in the House, in the Senate, and as Senator Monroe said, it did pass unanimously over there, is something that I believe he is comfortable with in 2007. So again, thank you, and thank the folks that worked on this bill, and we appreciate being allowed to be part of that at the end stages. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or turn it over to Bill to talk about the kind of specifics in the bill from our perspective.
Please.
Mr. Chairman, I just would make one overriding statement, which I think the descriptions of the bill that have been presented so far today are accurate. The bill focuses on specific abuses and targets those abuses and does so with substantial penalties and opening the statute back to 1999. So it's targeted to address certain abuses, and that's what it does. And I think it's been a lot of work to get here, but I think it still has a lot of gives the department a lot of added emphasis on this area and some real tools that I'm sure they will use.
And Mr. Chair, for the record, that was
Bill Manny. Sorry,
I thought he had said that, but perhaps I missed it.
I thought he had. But
questions for this panel? I have one, and I don't know whether you have an answer for it or not. But we've been told that this is going to be part of a multi-state operation on the part of the Departments of Revenue. Many of the banks that you represent also operate multi-state, and I assume they're very cognizant of the issue and are prepared to work with it.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and not suggesting they need to, but yes, they are willing to work with that. And also, that was one of the reasons that I think allowed us to get to this compromise was the fact that there was going to be this multi-state voluntary compliance initiative put in place that allowed more than one state to accomplish the same goal. So that, I think that helped us get to where we are in 39A.
And the sharing of information between confidential departments like the Department of Revenue is important, isn't it, in understanding when these kinds of transactions are taking place?
I think what's important with respect to these transactions, first of all, is that they're following the federal definition of listed transactions and reportable transactions. And so that, I think, will be, in my view, probably the most valuable. I think it is possible that interstate information will help the department, but I'm not sure that it necessarily will, and that perhaps Walmart was doing what they were doing in multiple states. And in that event, it might be helpful, but it's not clear to me that all of these abuses are necessarily happening in multiple states. And therefore, I fully expect the department to have some unique situations to Oregon that might not come from that kind of information.
Thank you. Other questions?
Comment?
Yeah, Representative Butler.
Thank you very much. And I do appreciate Bill and Tim coming forward on behalf of the banking community. There will be questions that will undoubtedly come up under Section 2, and I know that certain things will appear to lack economic substance and reality, when in fact those may very well have excellent economic reality and substance to diversify a business interest, banks or otherwise, in multiple states. So I anticipate that, number one, the multi-state compact in which we are entering in with the Department of Revenue and with the other, particularly the western states and several eastern and midwestern states who have joined together in this same voluntary initiative approach, I think we're going to find some real good common ground, and there is some real, I think there is some real low-hanging fruit that we can pick here. And I think that by sharing the information, mining the data, and sharing the information, we'll overcome a significant problem that has been at least perceived in the past from a tax standpoint.
Thank you. Thank you. I wanted to simply add that we appreciate the bank's interest in this kind of issue and the fair administration of our tax laws, and appreciate your help in getting this bill into the form that it can be acted upon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on Senate Bill 39? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 39. And we'll move on to a public hearing on House Bill 2718. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2718.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you heard this bill last week, and the focus of today's was to provide another opportunity for folks to provide input on the Dash 3 amendments. Just to refresh memories, the Dash 3s essentially replaced the bill and make two changes. They allow local governments to impose a tax on state employee retirement benefit programs first, and it would also require the Department of Revenue to provide collection, enforcement, and administration and distribution services for local governments that impose a tax on income defined under 316, 317, or 318. The difference there being it requires the Department of Revenue to provide that service as opposed to it being an option under those conditions.
Thank you. If you'll recall, committee, we adopted the Dash 3 amendments, and unless I'm misunderstanding, does that essentially replace the bill? It doesn't, does it? It does. Essentially replaces the bill, so that's what we're looking at. We have one person signed up to testify on the bill today, and that's Robert Butler. Welcome again.
Well,
and for the record, would you state your name?
Humbled. I'm Robert Butler, and humbled by the hard work and sacrifices all of you make for this state. I come here as a friend and to share in that effort. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm here on invitation. What I feel is invitation from the legislative webpage for the state of Oregon, and that invitation, as I understand it, was that House Bill 2718 would have a public hearing today. It posted the original version of that House bill on the webpage, still is posted there. There is a note saying that there are three revisions not posted that will be part of this public hearing. If that invitation is correct, I will proceed with the fact that I've handed you a handout. The cover of the handout is what I wish to discuss briefly. The second document is a revision to House Bill 2718. And the next page is more of the same argument for the sham that the current version of the Multnomah Business Income Tax and City of Portland Business Tax is. And the last is the results rebuttal from the hearing that this bill had in 2001, where the City of Portland and the county refuted thinly at best of the problems with the bill. By way of background, Mr. Chair, Butler Brokers is a commercial real estate company. We've been in Portland for over 25 years. A major part of our industry is a commitment to the community. We make a generous contribution to the community, quite frankly, related to trying to support the industry. Our industry is our economic development and fuller employment. This is my fourth session I presented this bill. First one was presented in 2001. It had a public hearing. It had this information that I present at the back with what I refute in it. It passed the House, I believe it's in 2003. It didn't get a hearing in 2005. Got a hearing this year, this session. I've personally provided probably over $50,000 in my time and funds over the last 10 years for the good of this community, which this bill is good government, I believe. It's been a big sacrifice. I have very little personal gain. I would like to mention that the purpose of the original bill, as posted on the webpage, is to enhance commerce and to discourage the draconian type of tax treatment some communities are foisting upon small business. The reason for the change in the bill, which you see I have a change on the bill suggested, that's the implementation date. The implementation date is changed in the original concept from 2008 to 2009. I wanted to explain briefly why it was necessary to postpone that implementation date, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please do.
Since this bill was drafted in 2001, some rather recent events have occurred. One, which is very recent, we weren't even aware of it until about a month ago, was that Lane County has decided to put on the ballot essentially the Multnomah tax, business income tax type of business income tax for Lane County. We weren't aware of that. I do know that very recently Multnomah County, which collects the business income tax, has decided no longer to share with four cities, as it has for 15 years. Multnomah County, as of this July, will no longer be sharing any of those revenues with Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview. Those funds that were being shared are cut off as of the summer. Those four cities now have to scramble to replace those funds. It's quite possible they'll use the same template as Multnomah County, and here's four more governments looking for a business income tax at the minimum, because other counties are suffering greatly from the loss of federal revenues from timber. They're also looking for replacement schemes. Business income tax has been a logical one, now suddenly more than ever before. Thus, this bill is far more important now than it has been for the last 10 years. When Bobby Green came here from Lane County as the commissioner of Lane County, he testified against the bill. Since his testimony against the bill, by the way, his testimony is quite simple. We don't want to be told what to do. We can best determine, as Lane County, the best way to tax our business people. So, afterwards, I did talk to Commissioner Green. He was very polite. I said, why didn't you pick the Multnomah County version? And if I may go on, sir, he said, because it was the only one. There's only one business income tax, and it's a county tax in Oregon, Multnomah County. That's why. Sir, did you consider the possibility of using the Oregon Department of Revenue as the format? No, we did not. That's hearsay, but I suggest that it's true. That's my conversation. It's very regrettable that Lane County is doing this. I think they'll regret it. There was one saving grace. Important saving grace is that if Lane County passes this election, May election, they are passing, without this bill, they are passing the adoption of Multnomah County's very draconian tax treatment of small employers, which is a burden on commerce as well as an unreasonable burden on small business. The saving grace is that if House Bill 2718 with amendments passes and Lane County passes their business income tax, they will in effect be adopting the Oregon Department of Revenue template. That's the very saving grace for getting out of this deplorable, disappointing selection by Lane County. I'd like to mention that, and I'm about done, Chair, if I may, just to summarize. As an Oregonian, I have watched small business contribute to this community for many years. I had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Meyer, Fred Meyer, who I admire as a small business produce grocer who contributed greatly to the history of the state of Oregon. I had the pleasure of meeting a chairman of the board of a company called Heister Company, started in Portland. Ernie Swigert went to Chapman Grade School, didn't even finish high school. That company provided immense contributions to the state of Oregon. Greenbrier, I knew the founders of Greenbrier, one of the largest railroad car manufacturers in the country, Northwest Front Street, Portland, Oregon. My two brothers started that small business. Papay, because you're from other areas of the state, Papay, local family, down in near Medford. Les Schwab. These companies made our state. We should be encouraging small business to grow and make those kinds of contributions, and this good work, this good bill will do that. I have no objections to the amendments being offered in R3. As far as I'm concerned, they're unrelated to the original mission of the bill, and I don't object to them. I would urge that if you're interested in those as well, that we combine them into one bill. And thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Mr. Butler?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, the Dash 3 amendments, as I understand it, do in fact replace the bill and basically provide for, as opposed to the original bill, which requires local governments to impose taxes based upon a uniform method, this would make it optional that if they shall impose taxes, that if they do impose a tax and use the method as prescribed under chapters 316, 17, and 318, which are the corporate and individual income tax methods of calculating taxation, then the Department of Revenue shall provide and be available to that political subdivision for both the collection, the enforcement, administration, as well as the distribution of services of the tax provided by the Oregon Revised Statute, and that the political subdivision may then impose a tax on the employee retirement benefits. That substantially changes the nature, leaving open what Mr. Butler has referred to in Lane County. If it passes, they'll select their own pattern of taxation. And I think going back to Mr. Butler's original testimony, when he originally testified and indicated that in doing business within the city of Portland and some of its suburbs, that each of those various disparate political subdivisions had their own method of recalculating the tax. And that becomes then somewhat onerous to a small business to attempt, it shifts the burden basically to the small business to calculate and recalculate for each of those political subdivisions. Now, I'm also aware of when Commissioner Bobby Green was here that he had serious reservations about state law dictating to the local law or local municipalities and municipal subdivisions any kind of a basis upon which that was being done. However, he did express desire that the PERS issue should be addressed, I think, in the taxation and the definition and calculation of taxation for local governance of this. So I voted in favor. I was one of the five that voted in favor of keeping this bill alive when we heard it on the last day, or I guess there were seven of us that voted yes. I voted in favor of that on the last day of April to keep this bill alive, but I still would express angst about the ability for each and every political subdivision of this state to create their own separate disparate tax system and would encourage us to try and create some uniformity. The bill still is alive today as a result of the adoption in this hearing, and I'm still very anxious. And again, Mr. Butler's reference and refreshing us of the testimony of the concerns down in Lane County, we don't know what it's going to look like, but we don't want you to tell us what it's going to look like either. So I'm just concerned about that just gives rise to another whole different method of taxation, and I obviously we have lots of tax law developed around 316, 317, 318, and pretty good history, and so while the bill has been gutted, I certainly would like to have us come back and do something relative to the concerns that were originally expressed with this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Other comments while we're in public hearing? I guess I would simply, yes, please, Representative Webb.
Mr. Chairman, are we going to hear any testimony from the communities that were, in essence, cut off from sharing the Multnomah County business tax? They signed up.
There's nothing. The only person who signed up is Mr. Butler.
Thank you.
We haven't heard, and maybe I should ask him a question on that topic. Is that county tax shared with anybody else? Are they shared with Portland, for example?
The sharing is only with Portland. Has its own business income tax, so the sharing doesn't go to Portland.
Just the other.
It goes to those cities because they're the four major cities. I know Gresham very well. They don't know what they're going to do. They have a problem. They're going to find replacement revenue. They haven't hardly discussed it yet. There's been nothing official on their agenda. Mr. Chair, could I respond to
Representative Butler's comment? Absolutely.
Well, his comments are not totally in agreement with mine, but I appreciate the fact that he had interest in adopting more of the original RO. I think he hinted at that. If he did, I appreciate it. His comment that this is a whole different ball game, could open up all kinds of new taxing schemes and whatnot, it actually does just the opposite. If a local government voluntarily opts to have a business income tax, all they have to do is follow the general provisions of the Oregon Department of Revenue. There is absolutely no control of how much they collect, what rates. It only is that we're all on the same page. A deduction is a deduction. This helps commerce because we participate in governments, in local governments all over the state. Many businesses do, including small businesses. They all file a state tax return, so we're all on the same page, and we should all stay on that same page. And so I don't think it opens up a whole different scheme of anything. With regards to Lane County, I've checked with their legal department. Lane County's position is that they, on the ballot measure, they are voting to adopt the Multnomah County scheme. We know what it is, and that's the opinion of their legal department. And so the only saving grace is to accept House Bill 2718 in its original form, and then the vote in Lane County will work out. And we'll all benefit, including our commerce. And thank you for allowing me to answer, make that comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair, my concerns were relative to the Dash 3 amendments,
yes,
which modifies the bill, which just says if they choose to do this, then they can go about it in this fashion, as opposed to the original bill. And Mr. Butler is absolutely right. On the original bill, it sets up a uniform fashion for taxation.
Right. As I understand the original bill, what it basically said was you've got to follow you've got to pick some number off of the state tax return, in effect, from which you calculate what your tax is going to be. What I understand this bill to say, or this the -3 amendment to say, is if you pick some number off the state tax return as a basis for your calculations for your tax, then you can get the help of the Department of Revenue in collecting it.
Sir, may I attempt comment on that? I don't believe House Bill 2718 requires you to pick a number from anything. You can pick a number out of the phone book if you want. It's my personal opinion. What it does require you to do is we're all in the same vocabulary. A deduction is a deduction. A deduction on your federal return is a deduction on your state return and should be a deduction on your local return. And most of the problems with our small business income tax now is because Portland and Multnomah County and now these new governments have defined their own deductions, have their own vocabulary, and we all have different tax codes when we're really all filing a state return anyway. So why not be on the same page?
Thank you. I think that's a better explanation. Thank you very much. Anything else for Mr. Butler? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for your kind attention and your good work.
Mr. Chair, was Representative Witt's question answered relative to what of the local governments that may be affected as a result of what's happening right now in Multnomah County? Will we hear from those folks? Will we have an opportunity? And I guess the whole issue is the discussion which Mr. Butler has brought before us. That is, do we want to have a startup number? Do we want to avoid that, or do we want to go with the -3 amendment, which we've already adopted, not unanimously, but it was adopted so that we would keep the bill alive and be able to have further discussions. I think the revelation today about what's happening in Multnomah County with regard to some of those other smaller jurisdictions leaves those folks basically having to make a new decision, and I'm anxious about that.
Well, there's absolutely nothing in this bill, either form, that has anything to do with that issue.
No, there isn't.
Is there?
No.
I mean, how the county chooses to share its revenue is not related to this bill at all.
No, it isn't. The concern is, will we have now four new methods of calculating taxable income in four different jurisdictions?
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 2718? Going once. I don't see anyone. All right, with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2718. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 173. Thank you. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 173 is the bill that allows the Department of Revenue to disclose confidential information from tax returns to cities, counties, and other political subdivisions of states or an association established exclusively to provide services to federal, state, or local taxing authorities. And in this case, the only known association is the Federation of Tax Administrators. The use of the information must be for tax administration and compliance purposes only.
Thank you. And we have the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, in the earlier public hearing, there were two questions that I did not have answers for, and I've come back with a little bit more information. One of those was from Representative Olson as to what kind of security or audit is done of the database itself. The system that we're talking about is maintained by the New York State Department of Taxation and Finance. Each state under this program has an administrator, and each state is responsible for designating users who are authorized to access the database. So each state requests permission of the New York person to have a user authorized, and then there are passwords that apply. There's only one person that has the access to the database, and then the users go through that person to get access as well. The other question, and there are logs that track access by each user. So there's those security features. Another question was as to penalties that are imposed. Under Oregon law, for inappropriate disclosure of information, we have a Class C felony and a dollar penalty. Each signatory to the agreement, the disclosure rules for each state do apply. For example, California has a statute that provides any unwarranted disclosure is a misdemeanor. Washington State provides that a fine not exceeding $1,000, and then a violation, if it's an employee of the state, they cannot be employed for 2 years after that. So each state has its own disclosure laws that would apply to inappropriate disclosure of information received through the database. And Mr. Chair, if I could just also just follow up a little bit on the information. We currently share information with other states, not through the database, but on a one-to-one basis with the states. For example, and the information isn't only limited to looking at abusive tax shelters or abusive transactions. It's other information related to filing returns. As an example, if you had a corporation that's headquartered or domiciled in California, but they're doing business in Oregon and in California, we might ask California for information about the return that they filed with California. California might ask Oregon for information. And we can share that information under the current law. So you have authorized us to share that information. When might we want to do that? Well, you heard, I believe, in the earlier many months ago in January, in the corporate overview, about how corporations classify income as being either business income or non-business income. And what's important about that is business income is apportioned among the states where they do business. Non-business income goes to only one state, and that's the state where they're domiciled. So again, go back to this example of the corporation operating in Oregon and California. That company is dividing its business income between Oregon and California. If it has non-business income, that's going only to California. Now let's assume this corporation has a $10 million gain on the sale of an asset, and it's not entirely clear whether it ought to be classified as business or non-business income. So what if that corporation, on its California return, classifies it as business income? That means it's split between Oregon and California. Suppose on the Oregon return, it classifies it as non-business income. That means it goes to California only. So it's taking inconsistent positions on the two returns. We would know that if we could see the California return. California would know that if it could see the Oregon return. So does it make sense to allow the states to talk about the inconsistent filing position of that corporation so that they're reporting it in the same way on each return? If the states have the same law as to what is business and non-business income, it can't be both. And yet the corporation is saying it's both, depending on what is to its benefit. So again, it isn't only the abusive tax shelters, it's not only those types of transactions, but it's everyday business where we can find value in sharing information with other states. Mr. Chairman, I believe those were the only points I wanted to make, and I'd be happy to try to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Debbie, tell me about reciprocity amongst all 50 states and other municipalities, because this provides for, in addition to the political subdivisions themselves being other states, cities and counties sharing information, which heretofore has been sacrosanct.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Butler, and that is the primary reason for this. The database that I have talked about has other states participating in the exchange of information, but the City of New York is also a participant. So under current law, we are not able to provide information to the database because the city is a recipient, and current law does not authorize us to disclose to cities. this change would allow us then to be full participants in that particular database.
Follow up then,
please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The immediate past bill that we just looked at just a moment ago, I think 2718, also talked about the state participating with the Dash 3 amendment, state participating in information and assisting in the collection and negotiation and distribution of funds. I think there was a fourth item too. Deborah, with regard to this provision, if then account if 2718 was law and the information was available to the state, how much tax a subdivision, a political subdivision, was charging, and how it was calculated, then would you share that with other, for instance, the city of Portland, if you were administering the city of Portland's program, and under their current program you wouldn't be, but if you were administering the city of let's pick out, unless you were sitting, you're assisting the city of Salem and Marion County, and Marion County then decided to have an income tax as well as the city of Salem, then could you share that information back and forth so that the city knew what the county was taxing on and was reflecting as taxable income and vice versa?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, my reading of the language on page 2 of Senate Bill 173 is that if the political subdivision has laws regarding confidentiality that are at least as strict as those under the Internal Revenue Code, then we would be authorized to share that information. Because it says, for tax administration purposes, we can disclose to a city, county, or other political subdivision of a state.
And follow up if I may.
Yes, please.
As well as the city and county or other political subdivision. Now, Deborah, one more question in this regard. Last week I had a visit from some folks from the Department of Transportation, and they said that they wanted to have certain access of information from the Department of Revenue relative to taxes paid, where the person was working, current residences, other information, as well as any refunds that they might be entitled to. I've got departments of state government now that are coming forward and saying, we'd like to mine your data too, and that gives me some pause for concern.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I can understand why that would. Currently, unless it is specifically authorized in this statute, and then also in ORS 305620, which I don't have in front of me, but it is the one that authorizes us to disclose to the local government when they have a tax. I don't believe under current law we are authorized to disclose the information that you described. In fact, we don't even disclose whether a person has filed a return, let alone the tax amount or address, any of the information, unless it's already covered in the law.
Mr. Chair, my concern is that there is some indication that in another committee that Representative Reed sits on, I won't mention which committee that might be, that perhaps the Department of Transportation might be coming forward with a request to be able to mine some of that data. And I am anxious about state agencies. My whole life, Deborah, has been a practice of, this is so sacred that the information that you've got, that most everybody's lips are stapled shut before they walk into the building and after they've left the building. And now we have these kinds of bills and attempts to say, let's start sharing the information in a time when the state is being attacked on a daily basis. Your database silo is probably being attacked at least as many times as my email is up in the state office here. But it's phenomenal the number of attempts that people are trying to reach in and get information. And while you've been largely successful, and this isn't a ways and means process to ask you, you know, for a reporting of the success of that, while you've been largely successful in keeping that data out of third-party hands, my concern is, are we as sure about the city of Rochester, New York, or the city of Ipswich, that they will be as concerned about our data as we are?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, if I could just follow up on that. It is a concern, and it is a concern for us as well. And we have tried diligently to not only do the things technically that we need to do technologically to protect that data, but also with our employees. And I believe that other states in general have that same approach to the data that they have in their care, as does the Internal Revenue Service. So, but I understand the concern.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry that I've really gone almost too far, and this may broach over the top of it, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Have we had any breaches that have required our employees to have paid fines, lost their employment, or otherwise been sanctioned? Have there ever been any of those kinds of breaches where we've actually lost information of which you're aware?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I am not aware of any encroachment of our systems and loss of data. We have had in the past one instance of an employee who inappropriately disclosed information, and that employee no longer works for us, and we did follow up on that and took appropriate action.
And if I may, took appropriate action and additional protections were then installed.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, yes.
Thank you very much for indulging me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, that was one of the reasons why I asked the question last week of Deborah regarding the idea and the concept of an audit. It was actually kind of go right at the heart of what Representative Butler is concerned about. Just that assurance for accountability.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very
much.
Thank you, sir. Robert, is there anyone else who would like to be heard on the public hearing on Senate Bill 173? I'm not seeing anyone. Committee, while we're in public hearing, what thoughts do you have on this bill? Representative Butler, you raised a number of things which might be considered criticisms of the bill, but I'm not certain exactly what your views are.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I guess I'd want to know more about state agencies that would like to have access to the information. I am assured, and I, you know, Mr. Chair, let me say this, and we've had an opportunity as a committee to go through the department's office and had an opportunity to see what their procedures are that are in place. I think Oregon does an excellent job of maintaining the sanctity of the information and the confidentiality thereof. My concern is that I just don't have that kind of confidence when we move out to, and excuse me for saying it, I'm going to have to come to somebody else's district other than, I don't want to say Vail or Harper, Oregon, because that's in my district. But at any rate, I think you can get where I'm coming to, is that if we've got a little city of 50 or 100 people and they decide that they want the information and sign the agreements that say, and oh, by the way, this will all be protected information, and then we find out that they really don't have the kinds of protection procedures in place, that's of grave concern to me. And I think the department would act much more responsibly than just say, well, you say you do, therefore we'll turn the information over to you. I think they will act, and I think the bill provides that they will act more responsibly than that. But once it leaves the state of Oregon, I personally have never minded dealing with the state of New York, state of New Jersey, state of Idaho, you know, all of those folks around us, because I know that they have, and that Director Harchenko has excellent working relationships with those folks in a multi-state compact, and that they all, you know, swear the blood oath that they will absolutely maintain sacred the information that's entrusted to them. I am concerned when it goes, and I don't mind the department assisting in mining data for other agencies within the state. You want to know who files their tax returns, that all of the contractors are filing the tax returns. That was a project we were involved in a couple of years ago, that contractors were providing Social Security numbers, and they were able to do a cross match. And incidentally, the numbers were terrible with regard to the folks who were applying for state licenses. So very few of them were really filing tax returns.
Yeah, they weren't really working.
But they were paying their bonds and paying the necessary application fees. So I think that there's a great opportunity for us to work with that information within the state. My concern is that I just don't have the confidence when we start dealing with other jurisdictions, particularly if we make our data available to the state of Idaho, understanding that the state of Idaho will then make that data available to Weezer, Idaho, to Payette, to Fruitland, and they might be able to come back and mine that data for sales tax information. And that's of concern to me.
Representative Belzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the Health Committee, I'm kind of known for being very concerned about confidentiality and retention of information, as Representative Bruin can attest. However, in this case, appreciating the concerns about holding the information in other states, if I look at where we fall related to the rest of the nation in terms of participating in this exchange, I think that we can have some faith in how well this works, given that we are one of only 3 of 50 states that aren't participating. I think that the protection to our state revenue system of being able to be sure that our tax returns are being filed fairly outweighs the concerns that another state would break its own laws in terms of maintenance of information. I think the bill is pretty clear in its statement that the other entities to which the information is released must have that same level of assurance of confidentiality as we have here in Oregon. And because of that, I would be interested in seeing the bill move forward. I think it's an important tool for the Department of Revenue, and I've really appreciated Deborah's willingness to come back and answer the questions and make it clear to us. But I think it's a good proposal. It certainly doesn't come without some risk. Everything we do comes with some degree of risk. But as a native Nevadan, I look forward to leaving Nevada in the dust and moving my new home ahead of the desert state.
Thank you, Representative. Other comments? With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 173. Colleagues, we have 2 bills that we haven't worked. I'd like to talk just for a second about the potential for working those bills. There are issues on House Bill 2718 that I don't think have been explored thoroughly yet, and I think we ought to take a couple days to explore those issues before scheduling another, before holding a work session on that bill. And I'm wondering if committee members are of the same mind on Senate Bill 173. There are other issues that ought to be explored a bit, and we'll hold it over perhaps till Wednesday, and also House Bill 2718 until Wednesday for the work session that was originally scheduled for today. And I don't hear any comments on that, so that's what we'll do. And with that, we've exhausted our agenda for today, and we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.